I'd like to talk about some of the changes of COTC during the war. In September 1939, a credit was granted to undergraduates who passed the qualifying examinations.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Did you take a stand on that at the time, or help that decision come about in any way?
I took no part in having this arrangement made. I think this was a decision of the Senate of the university, but I believe it was discussed at the Association of Canadian Universities and Colleges or something, and there was sort of general agreement that this would be a policy across Canada. But I'm not very clear on the idea.
What do you think was the reasoning for that?
The reasoning for it?
Yes.
Oh, well, that the people put in the time. And you have to remember that in World War I, students were given a full year for enlisting, a year's credit. So it seemed fairly reasonable that a person might get one three-unit course, or one unit, I've forgotten which it was, credit for the amount of time you put in the COTC, provided he passed the examinations. And there was a good deal of studying to do, and this competed with the time a student had for his other studies.
Also, this time the National Defense Department instructed that the armed forces, the active services, and the militia had to take one half of their officers from COTC.
Mm-hmm.
That was also the beginning of the war. Do you remember, did this place immediate pressure upon COTC?
Yes, I don't think that this was enforced very much. My recollection is that this wasn't a very important item. I guess they had no difficulty getting the officers they needed, people volunteering from the university, but their officer requirements for the militia were rather limited, I think.
Another change was the A and B certificate. These were abandoned in favor of new Canadian standards, and these are prescribed in the manual.
Yes, I think that was fairly early in the war, yes. But when we started out, it was A and B certificate. And of course, as I told you, the syllabus for that must have been written shortly after the South African War, I think.
Mm-hmm. Can you specify what were the differences between the old A and B syllabus and then...
No, I can't recall the differences. They didn't have new, as far as I can recall, there were no published manuals. It came out in mimeograph material mainly, I think, the new requirements, new syllabus and so on.
Can you recall any sort of change in emphasis?
No, I don't recall.
Up until 1943, when the air and naval training units were introduced on campus, all COT training was land warfare oriented.
That's right.
Yet, in 1940-41-42, more than half of the officer cadets enrolled in the air and navy.
That's
right. Air Force and Navy.
Some of our senior cadet officers, when it came time to enlist, went into the Air Force. But they had been trained in the in military army training. But as I said before, I think that discipline and map reading and military law and these subjects are more or less common to all the services. Even the Air Force, they had to parade. You have to move people from one place to another, and you can only do that by getting them in parades and marching them off. Now they may have changed a little bit groupings, but the basic material is pretty much the same. There was very little difference. Even when these other branches of the service were introduced on the campus, their training wasn't very different. And when we'd have an inspection, well, these people would turn out and they go through the movements the same as the army people did.
Yeah. Well, They wouldn't have received a commission, officer's commission, though, in the other, in the Air Force or Navy, or would they have?
No, and I don't know whether they received a commission even after they'd taken the Air Force training on the campus. It may have counted something towards the, or they may have been taken in as officer cadets, but I don't think they were qualified. They certainly weren't qualified as pilots or navigators or anything when they left UBC.
But of course, if they joined the Army, they would have a good chance for the lieutenant's rank.
A second lieutenant, yeah.
Second lieutenant. One other item, controversial, is the UBC editorial. The UBC seems to be shaping up as the opposition here. February 1944, the UBC editor is concerned because you had expressed to the cadets, this is during a parade, that they as a group, the officer cadets as a group, should exert more influence in student affairs. Do you recall that at all?
Oh, I probably said that, but...
what would have prompted you?
Why shouldn't they? Because they were the whole student body except the women and the people who were medically unfit.
Yes. Yeah, they would have been the majority, vast majority.
Yes.
But... for what reason do you think they should have had more influence as a group, as a officers training group? Or?
Oh, I couldn't. I would just think that they were probably so engrossed in their military training and their studies and so on that they it was a danger that ordinary student affairs would be taken over by the women and the. And those who were excused as medically unfit, I guess, or underage. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was a very important time. As far as I can remember, at that stage in 1944, there weren't any burning issues. There was no objection to, strong objections to military training. But I guess that I was, I've always been fairly outspoken on matters and said, may have said this to stir them up a bit. But I don't feel that we were in any way threatened by student opinion, you know, that this was hampering the work of the Corps in any way.
Mm-hmm. Or you didn't feel that student government was, you felt the student government was cooperative enough or wouldn't?
As I recall, we never had any problem with the cooperation of the student government. We only had a little resistance from two deans. One was the Dean of Engineering, Dean Finneson, whom I mentioned the other day, and the other was Dean Clement, the Dean of Agriculture. Whenever we went on any of the fields on the campus, well, he was upset about this. And one day we had, through the cooperation of the military units downtown, we had a parachute drop on the campus to show the boys something about how this was done, and our people didn't jump, but they jumped out in the big field, the pasture field, where the medical buildings are now. That was a big pasture field. And when they dropped the material, then these men dropped too, quite a good show it was. And then they went and recovered the material and got in action and so on. A dean was terribly upset about this. It frightened the cows or tramped the grass, you know. And it was rather ridiculous to think that tramping a little grass in a pasture field was a concern when the military had gone to a lot of trouble and expense to put on this drop. I don't know how many people they dropped, but I would think it was close to a company. It was quite a sight. And they dropped the materials as well, bundles and CDs. It gave the students some idea what was involved in these things, you know. But in any case, so that we always had to be very careful not to go on the farmlands if we could avoid it.
Was Dean Finlayson on the Committee for Military Education?
Yeah, I think he was, yes.
What was the, what were these meetings like? Of course, you would have been attended, and the Chancellor and the President and... Yeah. Applied science faculty.
There was very little happened in those committees on military affairs, because the president, Clinton, I think, was always on my side. Anything that I brought to the committee passed the committee, as far as I can recall. There was never any problem. And these people didn't show any, Dean Finlayson didn't publicly or anything show any resistance to military training, and he certainly wouldn't in front of the president, you know. And of course, mind you, the president was the least military of all of them, but he was very, very conscientious about doing his duty as president of the university. And as I said before, he didn't let his personal feelings enter into what he felt was the duty of university president, which other university presidents had agreed they'd have military training on the campus, and he cooperated wholeheartedly. I give him great credit. He's a Quaker, you know, and naturally you just couldn't expect him to be as enthusiastic as Dean Brock. Of course, Dean Brock was, in some respects, a real militarist. But then he was killed in an accident, and Dean Finlayson eventually took over from him.
How about Dean Buchanan? This is going back, of course.
Dean Buchanan was a Baptist, I believe, and he wasn't very enthusiastic about military training either. The three deans were not, and no one of them had as good an excuse as Dr. Klink, but Dr. Klink, I could always rely upon him, and therefore the Committee on Military Studies was never a problem so far as I was concerned.
Chancellor McKechnie, also, he would be on the
committee. Well, Chancellor McKechnie would be very strong for the military training. Anything that we used to meet down in his office very often downtown, the military committee. The meetings wouldn't last very long, and everything would be approved. The chancellor and the president was always supporting me 100%, whatever reasonable request I made.
Did you always find yourself sort of the advocate of both military needs during these meetings?
No, I don't think I felt that I was an advocate. All I felt that was my duty was to carry out the commitments the university had made in regard to the thing to the government and agreement with other universities. I don't think that we tried to go farther or push military training. This certainly wasn't so. At the meetings, I remember the meetings in Toronto and so on, Dr. Klink was never outspoken about this. He always said whatever they agreed upon, University of British Columbia would comply and do it wholeheartedly. Now, we tried to have the best unit in Canada, but we didn't try to push military training at the expense of studies or anything. I think that there should have been more military training or anything. This never came up.
I see. Can you recall any instances where there was a conflict during these committee meetings over, say, priorities as far as the military or academic?
I don't recall any, no. There may have been some feeling on the part of these three deans, but it was never expressed very openly in the committee meeting. I don't think that any of the three of them were wholeheartedly behind the program. Each felt that his own faculty had more important academic responsibilities, and that if there was no military training at all, that they might turn out better graduates who could help win the war because of the training, academic training, which they had received, and that any interference of that academic training was not helping in the war effort. Now, I would think that would be the basis for any opposition that they had, but it was never, as far as I can recall, never expressed. I had very cordial relations with them, but I knew there was this feeling was there.
Did you feel any conflict of interest within yourself being head of the physics department and also commanding officer of the armed?
No, I don't think so, because in the physics department, we were quite involved, became involved in radar training and the technical aspects of warfare. No, I never had any problem there, I don't think.
With the introduction of the two other branches of the service, and generally the whole expanding, mushrooming military establishment on campus, did the committee itself have to undergo any reorganization?
Not that I recall, I don't think so.
The Committee
on Military Studies, it didn't meet very often. It met to receive reports and so on. The Committee on Military Studies didn't in any way direct the program or, you see, and they didn't finance it, so that there wasn't much, the financing came through directly between me and the military people, in either in Ottawa or headquarters in Victoria, you see. So that the accommodation, we provided our own accommodation in the armories, so there wasn't really very much for the Committee on Military Studies to do other than to keep them informed what was going on and that we were operating within our sort of terms of reference.
Mm-hmm. Well, wasn't the committee kind of an intermediary, though, between university interests and the military interests?
That's a good point. There was a point that I wanted to put pressure on Ottawa or the military downtown, I would get the Committee on Military Studies. If I couldn't manage this myself, you know, or I get the Committee on Military Studies to send them a letter supporting my position. So from that point of view, but this didn't happen very often. But they carried quite a bit of weight with the military authorities in this province and in Ottawa, the Committee on Military Studies.
Your role, of course, as commanding officer, and you're also director of military affairs on campus, would have also expanded greatly compared to before the war. How did that change your job?
Like in the university?
As a military commander.
Oh. Well, as I think I explained earlier, I wasn't a military man. I wasn't a Dean Brock in that sense. I got coaxed into this job, and then when the war came along, I had offers to go to Ottawa and different jobs. As a matter of fact, I was wanted to get overseas, and I couldn't manage this. The Board of Governors, this went before the Board of Governors. I had all arranged to go, and the Board of Governors simply said no, that they would not permit it. And they thought that the work I was doing at the university, both in the physics department and war work there and in the COTC and so on, that this was so important that they wouldn't agree to it in any case. And so I just felt that, I do my best here. If I'm stuck here, that's it.
Why did you want to go overseas?
Oh, I don't know. I think nearly everybody wanted to go overseas.
Just because it sounds out of
it. I've been an old soldier. I'm a wartime soldier, not a peacetime soldier. A war came along. Well, I didn't want to be in Vancouver. I wanted to be nearer, either, if not overseas, then in Ottawa or someplace.
You were directly involved with the war effort. You wanted to be even more closely involved with
that's right, when the war was on, yeah. And, I also tried to get General McNaughton, whom I knew quite well, who was head of the National Research Council. And of course, he dropped that job immediately and went on active service. And I put some proposals to him even if I could get overseas to do scientific studies, closer to the battle zone, that's what I wanted to be. But he wrote back the same sort of letter saying, well, the things you're doing there and the way the COTC is going and so forth, that you're doing a good job and being appreciated and stay with it. But that didn't really satisfy me. And eventually I really signed up with Victor Sifton. I just forgotten what his official title was, and agreed to go. But then I thought maybe before I went I should get permission from the Board of Governors, and so I put it up to Dr. Klink, and he said, well, he would take it to the board, but he wouldn't recommend it himself either. So it went before the board, and they turned it down flat. So I had to stay with the CODC, and I didn't feel that, I just felt that this, I put all my time into it. I didn't have any other hobbies or anything, and I was able to carry on my other work.
Well, was your role, though, much more, say, administrative, though, during the war, because of the vast amount of, you know, I guess administration work that would be required?
Well, of course, I had staff, and I think I've had some success in my life as administrator, and this has involved getting competent people surrounding me, giving them the job and expecting them to do it without very much interference from me.
One of your adjutants was Captain or Major Topping?
Yes. I was thinking the other day, oh, you could talk to Topping, he's still around. Another man you could talk to, he'd be quite good. I was thinking about it afterwards, and that's Sheridan Walmsley, S.E. Walmsley. He was the adjutant for most of the period during the war, and he sort of reflected my strict discipline, and he went, I thought, maybe a little too extreme sometimes, but in any case, he did a very good job, and he was a good administrator from handling records and so forth and so on. Now, he was there for 3 or 4 years as an adjutant. He'd been a school teacher at Kitsilano, and he went back to Kitsilano and later was in charge of adult education or evening class or something for the school board. He just retired a year ago, but he's selling insurance now. You could get hold of him because he could tell you some stories about the discipline side of it, because this was the adjutant's job more or less, to parade these people and enforce whatever punishment was meted out to them.
Yeah, Captain Ritterhoff? I'm not sure.
Ritterhoff. He was an interesting fellow, too. He was a member of the university staff. And he's about a professor of classics. He's about the last people you would think would take a keen interest in the military, but he was very keenly interested. And although he wasn't the world's smartest soldier, he tried hard. And he was our intelligence officer. And some interesting stories about intelligence. He's a very sharp fellow and very interesting, yeah.
Intelligence officer, why would this be required on the UBC campus?
Oh, well, you'd be surprised. Yes, he's around, I think. He's an odd, I wrote a book here recently, poems. He was always at lunch, had some little couplet that had a classical connotation or something, but he was very interesting.
Colonel Logan, too, was a classic, wasn't he?
Yes.
1944, President McKenzie succeeded President Klink.
That's right.
Did this result in any changes, or?
Well, President McKenzie was always enjoyed his popularity. Dr. Klink didn't aim for popularity, so that there was a little difference. As a matter of fact, I think back in Toronto, when this idea the university should take military training was first brought up, Dr. McKenzie there representing, I think, the University of New Brunswick, and he was one of the few university professors that thought maybe the university shouldn't be involved in military training at all. Now, even although he had had a splendid record in World War I and had more background than most of the other university presidents, and certainly Dr. Klink, who never had any military training in his life, but by the time he came here, he was pretty well convinced that this was a good thing to do, and he was very cooperative. But there was something very solid about Dr. Kling, his position. And Dr. McKenzie always supported me, but there was just a little difference.
Mm-hmm. Also, Chancellor...
Of course, it was close to the end of the war then, anyway.
Chancellor Hamburger.
Well, he was very strong. Oh, he was even much stronger than Chancellor McKechnie. And Hamburger had a great deal of influence in the city, more than Dr. McKechnie probably, because he was somewhat younger. But he was very, very wholehearted in his support of anything military.
Mm-hmm.
Never any problem there. He was just as strong as Chancellor McKechnie, but in a position to push his ideas a little more than Dr. McKechnie, because he was full-time a sort of chancellor. He was the first chancellor, I think, that moved in a desk up at the university and thought of being there quite frequently, you know. Chancellor McKechnie, he was an outstanding surgeon here in the city, even when he was a very old man. He was probably the outstanding surgeon, and he had a very busy medical practice that we could only work in this. But Hamburger was—he was retired, even more or less full-time chancellor. Not quite as much as Phyllis Ross was when she became chancellor. She not only had a desk and so on at the university, she had a full-time secretary.
Summing up, what do you think was the main third contribution of Canadian Officers Training Corps to the war effort?
To the War Office. Well, it provided them with young people, some of the ablest young people in the community, with university background and with some basic training, so that they it may have saved 3 or 4 months in their training and the expense of training them for 3 or 4 months. It gave them a reserve of officers that they could draw upon as they needed them. I think it was, they could have gone along without it, but they would have taken in university graduates without any basic training at all, and it would have taken that much longer if you train them for officers overseas. Now, I was very disappointed, and I say I'm not a peacetime military man, I was very disappointed after the war, quite a bit after the war, when eventually the government decided they couldn't afford to continue the military training on the campus, and so the units were disbanded. I think that was a great mistake. There weren't very many students involved, but there were a few students who were interested in this, and the cost was, it was a flimsy excuse to say that the government couldn't afford it. And this, I think, was a very great mistake, because it's an important thing, I think, for the country to have a few people with university training who have some basic knowledge of military problems, military history, so forth.
Would you, similarly then, the way the Corps had kept functioning during the 30s, when the war did come about,
yeah,
at least you had a basic organization.
That's right. This was established when the war broke out, as I said earlier. We were practically the only organization in the province that could train officers. It had the syllabus, and we didn't have the staff, but we had the organization, and we were able to expand and give training to 1,800 students just like overnight almost, you see. So I think it was a mistake for they kept most of the militia units going. They're still operating, but they dropped the training on the university campus. Now, maybe every university wouldn't want to continue to do it, but at UBC we had very good facilities. We had the armory, and there was a small body of students. It doesn't have to be large, maintained this, and there was no effort made to by the student body to drive them off the campus and say this was out of keeping with. Might have been if they hadn't been dissolved before the revolution broke out in 1967 or whatever it is. There might have been trouble then, I don't know, as it was in the States. But by this time, the units had been disbanded. Well, I think, too, the fact that our students waived their pay and built an armory. No other COGC in Canada did that. And that must be a mark of high morale, that willing to do this and enthusiasm. And as I recall, there was never any national competition in which our contingent didn't either rank first or near the top. This also carried over into the radar training. Here we had national examinations for these radar mechanics that we had at the university. This is a semi, came under me too. It was a, sort of an offshoot of the COGC and the physics department, I suppose. But we ranked first in that. There was no argument about this because they took national examinations and the results were published. And we were by far the best.
How about the regular army? Did they seek out EDC officer cadets more so than from other universities?
Well, no, there would be no way of measuring that because our people went to local units in British Columbia, Seaforth and Canadian Scottish and so forth, and they weren't drafted by units in other parts of Canada. These units, they used to come and interview the students. They were anxious to get young men with character and physical, well-developed physically and so on, more so than the amount of training they had. They looked upon the training as a bit of indoctrination for these people, but I don't think they were so concerned. The militia, the active service units weren't so concerned with how much we had actually taught these people because they were going to take them in and make them officers in any case, you see.
Mm-hmm. Were you connected at all with the defense, the gun emplacements below the cliffs of Point Grey?
We had no connection with it at all.
That was all run by the regular forces?
Yes, and that was very hush-hush and so forth.
Oh.
So we weren't allowed down there. I don't ever recall going down there myself.
Were there regular units on campus to who manned those?
Well, they had their own quarters. It was all fenced off with barbed wire and so on, and we had no connection with it at all. Didn't call out upon us for any assistance or anything.
Were you allowed to walk down to the beach?
No, you couldn't. There was no way you could get in. That was all barbed wire, you see. Both on above and down below. You couldn't get close to it.
What do you think is the main value of military training to the individual? I'm not thinking in terms of what you would contribute to the services. But.
Well, I think the individual, first of all, is a question of discipline. Doesn't matter where he goes in business, he's going to be subject to a certain amount of discipline, and it may not be exactly, it isn't the same as military discipline, but if one is introduced to strict discipline, then I don't think that, I think when you go out in business or school teaching or whatever it is, you know something of the fundamentals, you know what was wrong with the military type of discipline, and you may either if you're responsible for other people, well, you have some ideas of how to handle this problem of discipline. And if you're disciplined yourself, you realize that, this man is senior to me, so provided he takes the responsibility, then I'll do as he tells me. I've always felt that it, senior person tells somebody to do something, and then it goes sour, that he shouldn't blame the fellow to do it. He should take the blame himself because it was his instruction. But this, as far as I can see, is the main benefit of the military training, that you learn how to handle men. And you don't handle them the same way in civilian life, but at least you have one method that you've been exposed to. And you probably, I think as I did when I was in the service as a gunner, I realized the things I didn't like about it, you know. But I am certain that I could never have accomplished the thing that I have, with my limited ability, with the military training that I've had at different times. It has been a tremendous help to me. It's been a tremendous help to me. As I said, I think I'm a fairly good administrator. Well, I think I've learned some of that from the military, because in the military you have a chain of command, and everybody's expected to carry out his part of the program. And if he doesn't, the whole thing breaks down very quickly. It breaks down more quickly. You see it. Then, in the civilian job, maybe, or something, you see. So you realize the importance of having every person, regardless of their seniority, should look upon his job as a key position, key job, if the whole program is going to function. And this is, in active service, this is tremendously important in battle. You say that the chain is as strong as the weakest link, you see it right there, you know. If any part fails, the communication signals or supply of munitions or communication of orders and all these things, I would say that it's something like a chess game, military. More like chess than any other game I know of.
The military training became no longer compulsory. This was the year 45, 46, in turn 45, 46. There was no longer compulsory military service or training. You spoke to a freshman class. You said that possibly physical training might become a compulsory part of a student's program. This would have to be subject to approval of the board. And possibly then military training, could be an alternative.
Yeah. Well, it was, physical training was compulsory after the war. Because I think during the war they realized how important the physical fitness was. And but this didn't work. I don't think you can't have compulsory physical education any more than you have compulsory military education on campus, except in wartime. Only in wartime would compulsory military training be acceptable. And we certainly found here at the university at UBC, where we had compulsory physical education, it was of very little value. Because we first had a great deal of physical education in the Army, but even with the Army discipline, as strong as it was, if a man doesn't want to do the exercises with some vigor, well, it doesn't do him much good. And the only way that you can do that is by long route marches and running and so on. But when it comes to physical, what they used to call physical jerks, I never found any way of making fellows get any benefit from it if they didn't want to. They can go through the motions, but it's how you go through the motions where you derive the benefit of it.
Did you play a part in having a decision come about to have compulsory physical training? Did you, speak to the president or bring it up at the committee?
I don't know if I played any part, but if I played any part, I know my sympathies at the time were that those taking part in games, playing games on the campus, and those taking military training should be exempt from compulsory military training. I can remember, but I don't remember playing any part in pushing this compulsory. But because I think I felt that it wouldn't be very successful, but that if they did have it, as I said, then those who were participating in games or in COPC, similar activities would be.
Just before you relinquished the command, January 1946, there was a bunch of in honor of Mr. Clear, and it was attended by two officers, veterans of the Corps and director of military training. And at this meeting, they reportedly discussed your future military training. This is an informal discussion. I wonder if you have any memory of that discussion.
No, I wouldn't remember. In any case, General Preyer wasn't a very, at that time in life, very stimulating personality in my estimation. So I don't think we had a very exciting discussion. Now, if you had said Colonel Ralston, then I would have said quite like it, because I found him a very stimulating. He was Minister of National Defense. He was out there.
You met with Colonel Ralston?
Oh, several times, and I always found him to be have a very business-like approach, but man with ideas, and he wasn't surrounded by the taking the right opportunity, but that probably was because he didn't have much to do. General Ralston and C.D. Howe were two ministers that during the war that I thought were really outstanding. Any meetings I ever had with them, I went away respecting their ability, their dedication, and on the yes, but I never found this. And I didn't know him well enough, or probably didn't have enough personal discussions with him, but I never found this very
exciting. Yeah, so it's going to be in February 1946, and that was your last March pass.
Oh, yeah.
Commanding officer. And after that, you're out of the Corps completely. Did you have any reflections of that time? Do you have any now about how you felt? You've been in the Corps for a very long time.
Well, I guess I've had some satisfaction in being conceited enough to feel that I've done a good job, and I was very proud of them, and I was very happy that I was being succeeded by Bob Bonner, who was so much younger and was a graduate of UBC and was very capable of carrying on. He'd been my training officer, of course. He got wounded overseas and came back, and he was one of the training officers.
He was very young, probably 25 or 26. Didn't you have any reservations about his age?
No.
None at all?
No. I never have any reservations about people's age if they're capable enough of doing the job. I always operate on that basis.
After the war, you served on the board which selects officer cadets out of those applying to get on the program. Okay, program. What qualities do you emphasize in your decision?
Well, I don't remember too much, but I remember one thing that I always cross-examined them myself to see whether they were coming in because they wanted to take military training or because they wanted to supplement their income or get some other summer employment or something of this sort. I was very anxious that the money that we spent, we had a limited number, we could only admit a limited number, and that they were people who were anxious to follow a military career or take some part in the militia as an officer when they graduated. This was one of the reasons that I think Department of Defense in Ottawa got a little sour on the COTC after the war, was that although they spent money on these people and trained them, very few of them went into the militia afterwards as officers. And the militia was very short of officers and couldn't get them. But the difficulty was that a young engineer, he graduated from UBC, His first job isn't in Vancouver, it may be way up at Vanderhoof someplace. So he had no way that he could take part. Or these students, if they were really good, they were going off to some other university for graduate work or something. And so it didn't appeal to them to be active in the militia downtown. There's a great deal of social obligations and so forth that they neither could afford the money nor the time for it. So that there was quite a bit of criticism of the COBCs after the war that they didn't. The people they turned out after, they might be training at the university for 3 years or so. And then when they graduated the university, the militia units couldn't get them. They weren't interested. And I think that was one of the reasons that it wasn't that they couldn't afford the money, that they closed down the COBC. But I don't think it was a valid reason. I think it was still a very good idea to have an engineer in Vanderhoof who was interested enough to devote 3 years at the university as a military man. And if something happened and he were needed, he'd be available right away. But he couldn't get very enthusiastic about peacetime soldiering, and neither could I, you see. So I had the greatest sympathy with these fellows. I never tried to push any of them into the unit.
Commanding officer's annual report, quite a lengthy report. How are these written up? Did you author them yourself, or do you have some of your staff prepare all the detail on the promotion, summarizing the year's events?
Well, of course, Mr. Walmsley would do most of that. And they were very much the same, you know, so the report. They didn't vary very much. They just changed the figures and so on. I make some comment that I make myself, but he would prepare most all of that. I was busy. I had the extension department and the physics department as well as and immediately after the war I had the housing problem too. But so that's the point, as I say, of being a good administrator. I wouldn't be found dead working out the details of some of those tables, digging up the information to go into those tables. That's somebody else's job, not my job. My job is to see that he does it and does it correctly. That's on them. That's as far as I need to go.
In your commanding officer, were you conscious at all about having an image or having to protect the image? Any of this cross your mind?
An image of what?
As commanding officer, do you feel you have to protect a certain...
No, I think
I... standards or values. But.
No, I think I just did this automatically. I had been, as I said, an NCO in the University of Toronto Battery. And I was had only been off the farm 2 or 3 years before I went into that job. And I came from what they looked upon as a theological college, Victoria College. And I had medical students and dental students and engineers. And some of them senior to me in the university. And I had to command these people. And I learned how to do it. And I learned pretty much the hard way, but... I think by the time that I commanded the COPC, it was kind of a natural thing to do. It wasn't difficult. Because then I was a professor, and these were undergraduates, you know. But I never felt any real that this was any tension involved in taking a parade of 2,000 students, you know. Because there again, though, I was more concerned not with what the students did, but if each one of my officers knew what to do. You see, they're the ones that can follow it up, not the individual students. So that this is administration, really, military administration. Establishing your chain of command, having the right people in the right post. But also, nearly everybody can do a good job, but they can't do a good job in different jobs. You know, they can do one kind of good job. So therefore, it's very important you get people into the job that they can do well, and they like to do it. And quite important.